Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to feed the world? These days, we worry about a planet growing ever warmer and more crowded. But the essential challenge, growing enough food to sustain human health and getting that food to the places where hunger exists, hasn't changed much in the century since Russian botanist Nikolai Vavilov began his work. Vavilov traveled over five continents, including our own, collecting thousands of different seed varieties in a passionate quest to end hunger. Many people have praised his effort to collect and preserve these samples. But what often goes unrecognized is what my guest believes was Vavilov's most brilliant contribution to the world, his recognition that diversity of food crops is a critical hedge against hunger. Gary Paul Nabhan is an ethnobiologist, conservationist, and farmer, and a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. His new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. Gary, welcome to Think.
I'm grateful to be here with you.
How is crop diversity related to food security?
Well, it's our best bet hedging strategy against the unpredictable climates and political conditions that we have. So diversity is literally linked to our food security by the fact that if a few crops fail, others typically make it through and provide us some modicum of protection against hunger.
And yet, in the way things are moving now, we have a shrinking number of corporate farming entities. They have these patented seeds that are developed to guarantee high yields and consistent quality, but they're the same seeds used over and over and on vast amounts of land.
That's right. I think there are various critiques of genetic engineering and green revolution hybridization, but mine isn't so much about the strategy for breeding them as the fact that to make money, these corporations are putting them out on 20 million acres the same year. They have to make back their profits, so they stop selling other varieties and invest their whole promotional mechanism in getting farmers to plant just one.
So how do pests and diseases play into that formula?
Well, when you have a target that big, pests or diseases rapidly adapt and do what scientists call break down or overcome the resistance that the crop may have had genetically bred into it. So within just a couple years of the BT corn being put out on the market to control a larvae that infests corn, there were larvae resistant to Bacillus thuringiensis, this time-tried organic method of dealing with crop pests. And now that tool has become less useful because now insects have a response to it.
So in the same way that the people's kids get ear infections and the old antibiotic doesn't work anymore, the same thing happens with crop pests.
That's right. We have an arms race, in a sense. We're put on a revolving wheel of trying to add new sources of resistance that more rapidly break down, and so we end up defeating our original intention.
But, you know, Gary, agribusiness proponents will argue that we've got the technology, we'll just continue developing, better formulas, and we'll make sure that the people in the labs can protect crops from these threats. Why don't you buy into that?
Well, I am not against plant breeders as a profession. I think the best ones, though, are the ones that stay in touch with farmers and breed for a particular climate and landscape rather than trying to have a widely adaptable crop that can be planted from Maine to California. And I think that it's a different way of using the skills that a plant breeder has, and I think it's ultimately proven more successful that when we have a crop that is finally adapted to a particular place, like the ones that Vavilov collected, they have staying power over decades. They're not a flash-in-the-pan kind of solution to our agricultural challenges.
So let's go back and talk about him for a minute. He's the inspiration for a great deal of your work, certainly this project that you undertook. Why did he begin his quest to collect seeds?
You know, Russia and Eastern Europe had undergone over 100 famines in the centuries previous to his birth in 1887. Within 4 years of his birth, hundreds of thousands of people died in a major famine that shook the Russian psyche the same way the Depression and the Dust Bowl shook the American psyche. So people became ever more aware that they had to solve this problem of famine. And just as modern science hit Russia, and he was fortunate enough to be trained by some of the best evolutionary biologists and geneticists in all of Europe, just as that hit, Lenin allowed science to be used as a tool for dealing with the major health and food security problems of Russia. And Vavilov believed that his time could be best spent as a scientist if he dealt with this issue of collecting diversity and looking for disease and pest resistance in the many peasant crop varieties that had emerged in these centers of diversity around the world. So in Russia and in Europe overall, he's as famous as Darwin or Thomas Edison, but few Americans know of him.
Ethnobiologist Gary Paul Nabhan is my guest. His new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. So he did come to some really interesting conclusions about biodiversity in particular regions. Can you talk about what he began to notice?
Well, yes, and it's ironic that now many people are aware of this term biodiversity and know that certain areas like rainforest are richer in it. But Vavilov was the first one to map these particularly rich areas. He was looking for a diversity of wild relatives of crops and of crop land races, which is the scientific term for what we may call heirloom vegetables today. But the point is that he was a very good geographer, and he noticed that just a few areas, 6 to 8, depending on which version of his map you look at, contain about 90% of all the crop diversity on the entire planet, Central Asia, Ethiopia, the Mediterranean coastlines of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Andes. And he targeted searches by himself and by other Russian scientists to collect and evaluate the diversity from those places.
And how did he find the local people really making use of what was there?
Well, that was his particular insight. He was also trained as an ethnographer or a field anthropologist and a linguist. He knew 15 languages. He could converse with many farmers, and he asked them what they were doing with the diversity, something unprecedented. He recorded how many varieties they grew in their fields and just what that mix of varieties happened to accomplish at a particular elevation in a particular climactic zone. And so he began to realize that the traditional knowledge of farmers and the seeds together formed a bridge by which we could devise some strategies to fend off famine.
So is the assumption that biodiversity will eventually draw a population to a particular region, or that the intersection of diverse cultures ensures that biodiversity is sustained in those places?
Well, this is being hotly debated now, and I've been in on meetings at the Smithsonian and University of California on this. What an interesting coincidence at first when you look at the diversity of languages or cultures in the world and where biologists map the highest diversity of plants and animals. They're about the same regions around the planet. And the thought is that both kinds of diversity are fostered by a complex topographic landscape where there tends to be isolation between valleys just 20 or 30 miles away from each other as the crow flies. But the crow can fly, and the humans up until the development of airplanes or highway travel by cars grew their plants in relative isolation, and wild species evolved in relative isolation. So in these heterogeneous habitats, these topographically complex areas, you foster both biodiversity and cultural diversity. And interestingly enough, they're the last places to be dominated by monoculture and globalization. So it may be that other areas like the Great Plains of the U.S. were once more diverse, but look what we've done to it. We've replaced a diverse prairie ecosystem dominated by bison with field ecosystems dominated by corn, soybeans, and wheat.
So when you decided that you wanted to retrace Vavilov's steps, what did you hope to find?
Well, I had been an understudy to some scientists that tried to look at environmental change by finding an early benchmark in history, someone who took great notes and great photos. And then you go into the field and you begin to ask questions about how things have changed and what people feel those changes were triggered by. So I had no assumptions in advance of what I would find. I just knew that if I could use Vavilov's fine, detailed field notes and his photos, show them to local people and ask them about the changes since then, that we would detect some things we hadn't imagined before. And I was right about that.
Yeah, one of the remarkable things that you discovered was that farmers who were working on very traditional pieces of land that have been farmed for thousands of years and in very traditional methods have, in fact, already absolutely noticed the effects of global climate change and are already responding to them.
This was kind of one of the most thrilling realizations for me in the field. We were in one of the highest agricultural landscapes in the world in the Pamirs of Tajikistan that are sort of bordered by the Hindu Kush on the south and the Tian Shan Mountains on the far east. And I looked at Vavilov's notes for the highest elevation of different crops during his time and some earlier notes that he had found of someone doing the same thing in the 1890s. And I realized that farmers today were growing some of those same crop varieties 1,500 feet higher than they could during Vavilov's time because the rapid melting of glaciers since World War II had completely changed the local climates, pushing warmer weather zones up the valleys towards the melting glaciers higher and higher so that wheat and barley that couldn't be grown at, say, higher than 8,000 feet before were drifting up to higher and higher elevations. And so we could detect with about 40 crops that there had been significant changes in their, what scientists call their elevational amplitude or range along an elevational gradient in response to climate change, and that farmers were dynamically responding to the climate change. They were not passive victims. Farmers are very smart. As they detect some change, they begin to respond to it so they're not overwhelmed by it.
And part of the reason they're able to do this is because they have access to different varieties of the same plants.
That's right. And so the interesting political irony was that for a long time, the farmers in Tajikistan found it difficult to get seeds from the south of their homeland in Afghanistan, where some of the people speak the same language. There has been made possible the last 10 years, a seed exchange across the Afghan-Tajikistan border, and now farmers with their own varieties, ones they develop themselves, are adapting to this change.
Gary Paul Nabhan is my guest. He's an ethnobiologist and a MacArthur Genius Fellow. His new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. We'll be back to our discussion in just a moment. We'll talk about how eating local plays into all of this here in this country. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gary Paul Napan. His new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One of the things you found, Gary, that's very interesting is that as local farmers in these traditional cultures are adjusting to changing realities with the climate, they are not typically using what commercial farmers in large plantations would do, which is adjusting fertilizers and adding more water. They are sort of working on this with very little resources.
That's right. They're trying to get stable yields by minimum input, but by growing a diversity of crops that respond differently, each variety to the weather. So they're doing what scientists call polycultures or mixed cropping. And this is very, very interesting. And I think that's why seed banks are not the only way that we should be conserving crop diversity. It really needs to be out in our fields, particularly in this incredibly unpredictable moment in human history that we're living in, not only with economic collapses, but with rapid climate change. There's so few things that scientists can adequately predict at this point that using diversity as a guide to help tell us which way things are changing is a very wise way of responding to the unpredictability.
So essentially what you want to do is put down as many chips as you can because one of them will strike and the others may not.
That's right. Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Now, is this kind of farming really scalable, though?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, and you can see it in the United States, is that we've lost not only small-scale agriculture, but what my friend Fred Kirschman calls agriculture of the middle. So we only have very large farms now, and they're dramatically affected by the fuel crisis that we're having right now because they're expected to provide enough of one commodity to ship all the way across the country. When we have diversified local agriculture, it's not as vulnerable to radical changes in the cost of inputs like fossil fuel and fossil groundwater.
How important is the eat local mantra in all of this?
Well, I did a book about 2001 called Coming Home to Eat. Since that time, we've seen the growth of locally produced foods being sold in local venues go from $2 million a year to over $6 billion, from $2 billion to over $6 billion. And it's a rapidly growing portion of the food economy, and even big companies like Sysco, that I believe has one of its headquarters in your area, is responding to the rising cost of fossil fuels by relocalizing or re-regionalizing their food distribution network. So say the food service closest to your building has a manager that when he wants asparagus or broccoli, he now goes online and sees the closest possible place on the truck route of his food company that can provide that. And that means we now have an incentive for a diversified local agriculture again that we haven't had for the last 50 years.
Can you talk, Gary, about some of the things that we don't even really consider to be food today that our ancestors might have eaten on a regular basis?
Well, another book that I've edited and published this year, Renewing America's Food Traditions, talks about 1,200 kinds of foods, marine and terrestrial, plant and animal, that are now at risk in North America. And these range from things like the American chestnut, which, of course, was wiped out by diseases, to reptiles, sea turtles and chuckwallas and rattlesnakes, that I certainly don't want to see back on the American table in a way that further endangers them, but were once part of the dietary of certain coastal and desert groups. Mesquite, a plant that grows over much of Texas, has been eaten in Texas for over 8,000 years And there's efforts by Slow Food and other groups to revive its production in both the U.S. and Mexico. Grain amaranth, one of the earliest crops, a cereal-like grain that you can pop, is now in some breakfast cereals. But people are, again, bringing it back as a staple crop in some areas. So we want to use that diversity of foods again to revitalize this local agriculture, so that local doesn't simply mean the same variety of arugula being grown from coast to coast, from California to Maine, but in each of the food sheds or ecoregions of the country, we have the foods best adapted to the growing conditions there, and hopefully that will mean that they require less fossil groundwater and fossil fuel.
So many people now, Gary, live in urban areas, particularly in the developed world, where residents might originate from cultures and from places with food traditions that are nothing like the ones where they live now. And I'm wondering how much that has contributed to this idea that we have that we can and should have food from however many thousands of miles away it can be produced.
I think that's one element of it. I think you're right on that point. I mean, we have refugees in the United States from war-torn areas around the world, and the last thing that they give up when they move to the United States is their food traditions. But ironically, you can discover the new place you're living and maintain those traditions by what I would call metaphorical sourcing. For instance, I'm of Lebanese descent. I used to send off to Lebanon to my cousins for a spice called za'atar, another one called simic, that's like a sumac berry, and grape leaves. Now I go to the wild grape leaves in Arizona, the wild sumacs here, and grind down their berries into a red powder that I put on hummus and other foods. And I get a za'atar-like spice from making my own mix of desert spices here in Arizona's desert. So I feel like I'm still honoring my tradition, but I'm locally sourcing something rather than sending off to Lebanon every time I want to connect with my own tradition.
Gary Paul Navahan is my guest. He's a MacArthur Genius Fellow, and his new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. An email from Kelly asks, what are your thoughts about agribusiness giant Monsanto suing farmers to gain control of their private seed stocks based on the contention that these seed stocks now belong to Monsanto by patent right, having been inadvertently cross-pollinated from nearby fields of bioengineered crops?
Well, I was one of the first scientists in the country to speak out against plant patenting in about 1978 or 79 when the Plant Variety Protection Act came up. I just don't think we should own other life forms. Now, that may sound like I'm hardcore animal rights or plants rights activist, but the point is that even when we try to patent them and then monitor that, our regulatory system fails because plants and animals evolve. And now we have large corporations like Monsanto suing other large corporations because one is trying to patent a process, a genetic process, another one, a particular gene. And I think the patent system will fall apart within the next 20 years because it's not providing the incentives for discovery and innovation like it once did. I don't want to villainize Monsanto, but I think the real problem is that you can patent can openers and car parts, but living organisms do not fit that model well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Rhonda in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good. I have a question about things we can and cannot eat, primary things that are plant-based. When I was growing up, my sisters and brothers and I, we used to just go through the woods in Alabama and Georgia, and we would eat all kinds of things. And we've all lived to be 40-plus years old now, so obviously it didn't kill us. But I'm concerned as to whether or not we can still eat things like that today. For instance, a lot of acorns are falling off the oak trees in my yard. Can we eat acorns without them killing us? And also, do you have any resources that would lead people to say, gosh, I've got this growing in my yard. Is it suitable for eating, for instance?
Well, thank you, Rhonda. Those are great questions. I eat a lot of wild foods. I helped found the first community-supported wild foraging project in the country that went after acorns and berries and wild horseradish and wild greens. And I love those foods. I discourage people from getting them near roadsides and obviously near toxic waste sites. But many of them are very, very nutritious, and they can be found inside cities and provide healthful benefits to us, things like portulaca or purslane, known to Spanish-speaking people as verdolacas, is as common in cities as it is in the countryside, and these are incredible sources of things like omega-3 fatty acids. We don't have to deplete the world's fisheries to get omega-3 fatty acids. Many of us have purslane in our own backyard, so thank you for bringing that up. There are a number of websites, if you look at Wild Food Adventures by a friend of mine in the Northwest, or the Desert Botanical Garden site in Arizona, they list the wild forageable foods that are in different regions. And so the Edible Wild Plants of Texas project based in Austin is an excellent source of this kind of information for you. Thank you.
It is discouraging that so many of us are so cut off from the source of our food that to eat something that's growing wild seems somehow worse and more dangerous than picking something up that's all shrink-wrapped at the grocery store.
I completely agree with you. It's such an irony because if you go to a place like Crete, they have 100 different kinds of wild greens in their spinach pies. Here in the U.S., we only know of the cultivated spinach ones, spanakopita, but their ortopita, their wild greens pies, are much more popular, 100 different kinds of them. And it's just a pleasure to see cuisines that still honor the wild food diversity of each place. And most of these foods are fairly common and can't be over-harvested. We now know of a few things like ramps and ginseng that are being over-harvested in a few parts of this country. But for the most part, wild foods are fairly resilient.
Ramps are like leeks, right? Like onions?
That's right. And there's a number of ramps festivals in the Appalachians, and they've undergone a great revival in the East.
One thing that's really interesting is that you think, with the exception of things that are endangered, the way to save particular food species that we might be in danger of losing is to convince people to start eating them in large amounts.
Well, this comes from my dear friend Poppy Tooker in New Orleans, who was one of the great New Orleans heroes of helping rebuild their food system after Katrina. And Poppy's grandmother said to her, honey, if you want to save it, eat it. What she meant, or what Poppy means by using that phrase today, is if there is no market demand for some of these rarities, if farmers have a great heirloom vegetable, but no one knows about it, no one knows its story or its nutritional value or its history, eventually that farmer is going to have to give that space over to something else that is more profitable for him or her because there's no demand for it. So with Slow Food USA and Chefs Collaborative and the great farmers markets that we have in Arizona and Texas and New Orleans, like the Crescent City Farmers Market in downtown New Orleans, we've literally brought back dozens of foods that had formerly fallen off the table by telling their story and bringing them back through special tastings and events like the American Heritage Picnics, a new national holiday that we're promoting.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Gary Paul Nabhan. His new book is called Where Our Food Comes From. Let's speak next to Kelly in Wichita Falls. Hello, Kelly.
Hi. I just have a question. What part of the mesquite is edible?
Oh, thank you for asking. It's the pods, not the seeds inside. I mean, you can have a specialized kind of hammer mill that grinds down the seeds as well. But if you just mash in a pestle the sort of beige-colored pods of the mesquite and soak them in water and then add a little bit of lime juice to that, you have an incredibly refreshing and nutritious iced tea kind of drink, or what I'm involved in through a slow food project in Mexico is fire roasting those pods in a chili roaster, grinding them, and they have this very smoky, wonderful flavor, just like the mesquite wood that we grill steaks on. But we use that for breads and tortillas and crepes, and it just has this incredibly rich smell. And you can read about the uses of mesquite on the Slow Food USA website or on my own website, GaryNabhan.com.
An email from Wes says, globally, are we as a species concurrently eliminating arable land in lower altitudes at a greater rate than it's being replaced in higher altitudes?
Absolutely. And one of the saddest things that I think is happening in states like Texas and Arizona is that we're putting our best farmland under pavement. And then if our population begins to grow, we'll have to go to increasingly marginal, rugged country to try to grow plants where we haven't plopped our cities and our freeways. And so I think we have to remember that this need to conserve biodiversity in our food system is directly linked to our need to preserve farmland. And there's many great groups working in Texas and at the national scale, like American Farmland Trust, to deal with this particular problem.
Do you think, given urban trends and people moving back into cities, it's more likely that we will see suburban areas being given over to farming, or are people more likely to sort of stay put and put up gardens in urban and suburban areas?
Well, I want more food production to go on in cities and in places like Portland and Eugene, Oregon. They're doing that in cities, but we need our farmland too, so let's make the best use of both.
Gary Paul Nabhan is here. We'll be back with him in just a moment. The new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU continuing and professional education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is ethnobiologist Gary Paul Nabhan. His new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One of the things that really comes through in the book, Gary, is how the crops that we have standardized in this country and around the world now for our own consumption are often not the most nutritious varietal of whatever seed we're talking about. In other words, there might be corn that comes up plump and white and large, but it might not have the same nutrients as something else that might have been used for hundreds of thousands of years.
That's right. Some of my own personal research has been a collaboration with nutritional chemists who have looked at the diversity of nutrients in beans, and that many of the beans that we've abandoned from common usage, like the tepary bean in the Southwest or certain kinds of lima beans or runner beans, are actually more nutritious and even help protect us from diabetes and heart disease in comparison with common beans like pinos or navies. And so it's not that these other beans are bad for us, but certainly one key element of this food biodiversity is that it also provides us nutritional diversity. If we're just eating, you know, 5-pound bags of Cheetos every day or one kind of corn, we don't get what we would get from a more diverse diet. And so one of Vavilov's students in Kazakhstan eats 19 kinds of apples a day to to keep the doctor away. He's 97 years old this year.
Let's talk about these wild apples, because this is a really interesting section of the book. First of all, would you talk a little bit about reconciliation ecology and what it is?
Well, I'm at a desert lab in Arizona with a brilliant scientist named Michael Rosenzweig, who came up with the term reconciliation ecology in a book called Win-Win Ecology. He's saying that we should not villainize people who live in cities for their impact on the environment, but try to better accommodate endangered species and all wild species in our cities and farmlands, that making room for the rarest of the rare, even in cities like Houston or Phoenix, is possible. We now have peregrine falcons living on skyscrapers in Phoenix. And the point is that a place like Kazakhstan, the fatherland of apples, is now planning a series of 50-some wild reserves for wild apples within its metropolitan area, so that the source area of all apple diversity that humankind benefits from will not be destroyed by future urbanization. That means having a certain area to maintain viable populations of these apples. You can't just do little postage stamp reserves, but if you plan properly, even within our urban areas, we can maintain a modicum of biodiversity.
Of course, things like apples don't grow well in Tucson, for example, where you live, but oranges and other citrus crops might. And so you've talked about possibly having entire regions trade with each other what they grow that is surplus.
Right. In other words, I don't think any of us will ever get to a 100% local food diet. But I remember growing up in the Midwest that it was a great gift at Christmas time when tangerines and oranges and pomegranates arrived from Florida for us to eat for the holidays. And there was those foods from extra local sources were cherished. And I think what we'll see in the future is fair trade between producers of different regions, so that the folks who have maple syrup in Vermont might trade, say, Texans for Texas longhorn beef, which is also rich in omega-3 fatty acids. A grass-fed Texas longhorn beef is a terrific thing, and some of it will be eaten outside of the region, but why not have direct trade between producers who have one regionally specific product, say in Vermont, with others in Texas, and use the concept of fair trade that we have with coffee to extend to our foodstuffs as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line is George in Fort Worth. Hi, George.
Hey, Mr. Nabhan. It's really exciting to get to talk to you. I had an ethnobotany class, and we read a lot of your stuff when I was in college, so I'm really excited to be asking you my question. I just finished reading Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Vegetable Miracle, where she spoke in depth about having heritage breeds of animals and how they were sort of dying out. And I wanted to know if you thought that, you know, beyond heritage breeds of animals, or also, you know, heritage vegetables and that sort of thing, do you think it's possible to incorporate those into a modern industrialized food system? Or do you think that, you know, the local food system is the only way for those things to be revived?
Well, I think most of it's happening at the local level, and I was a neighbor of Barbara's. In fact, I think she first saw heritage turkeys at my place in Tucson in the 1990s, and she continues to grow them, as do my wife and I. And we also grow a small herd of Navajo Churro sheep, and this is not on a large acreage. So I think some of these animals are adapted to a smaller or mid-sized scale of agriculture, but I think we're seeing a great revival of these heritage breeds thanks to the fine work of American Livestock Breeds Conservancy and American Grass-Fed Association. And I think we will see some of them go up to larger scales, but a lot of them are perfectly adapted over hundreds of years to small and medium-sized farms. And you have some great things in the Texas, Louisiana area, Piney Woods cattle and Gulf Coast sheep, and of course Texas Longhorns and Corianni cattle, and a hog that is associated with the Piney Woods of Louisiana, Mississippi, and East Texas. So there's a lot of work for Texans to do in this realm. So thank you for your questions, and I adore Barbara Kingsolver and all her writing, but Animal, Vegetable, and Miracle, I hope, is a book that everyone will read.
We actually had her on the show. She was terrific. Gary, so many people now are really into food and preparing it properly, and you know, chefs have become as recognizable as supermodels in some parts of the country. What role do professional cooks play in introducing the rest of us to eating these things that we have just walked right by for decades?
I think they reduce our fear level and increase our fun level. You know, I know personally some of the great chefs like Rick Bayless, who's a big proponent of these things, of getting people to try out ingredients that are novel and offer great textures and flavors and colors. And the irony is that over the last 50 years, we've made it seem that being a great chef is all about technique and visual appearance of a dish. We forget that the ingredients are just as much of the magic. And so in bringing back a lot of these foods like the Navajo Churro sheep, the chefs are guiding us on how to cook it with range-fed meats, for example, braising them and treating them differently than you would corn-fed feedlot beef is incredibly important to getting consumer acceptance to these. So the chefs are not perhaps someone to idolize, but someone to look at as guides to how we can best prepare these things. I don't think they want to be supermodels either. They want to be recognized for their skill and talent.
You mentioned irony a moment ago, and the extraordinary irony of the story of Nikolai Vavilov is that he ultimately died in a Soviet prison of starvation. How did he get blamed by Stalin for Soviet food shortages?
Well, this is the subject not only of my book, but a fine book by Peter Pringle called The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov. Stalin collectivized the farms, took them out of private land holdings of families, and use a Henry Ford model of assembly line agriculture, if you will, as an attempt to increase the yields of food in Russia. And it failed. A drought occurred in the mid-30s that killed millions of people in Russia. And Vavilov and his seeds kept the country from having a worse famine, but Stalin needed a scapegoat, and so he said that Vavilov's research plan was too long-term and elitist, and basically jailed him. And the man who collected more kinds of food and taught us more about how to eliminate famine, ironically, ended up starving to death in a Russian prison. And his son, Yuri Vavilov, will be in the country this month giving a talk at the National Agricultural Library that I hope to attend to remind Americans that this seed diversity has to be used in the context of what I would call food democracy, that if the seed diversity is attempted in a totalitarian state because the root causes of famine are political, not environmental. The people in a country stand to lose, not gain, from the seed diversity unless the political conditions favor a democracy and favor the rights of farmers.
What is the status of that collection today? It was preserved even after his death.
It was preserved in St. Petersburg and some field stations, but Russia went into the dark ages of pre-Darwinian science for another 20 years after Vavilov's starvation. And over that time, many of the seeds were neglected and lost their viability and died. Some of them, fortunately, had been dispersed to other seed banks and other collections and remain, but we have no idea of what percentage of the original collection survived. But now there's great scientists in St. Petersburg recollecting from the very same places, and the Vavilov Institute, I think, is as remarkable as any art museum in the world, particularly as remarkable as the Hermitage a few blocks away from it, is one of the great contributions of humankind.
It's an interesting comparison, and both of them were sort of holdouts during the war.
That's right.
Can you talk about maybe some of the best things that you learned in visiting local farmers all over the world for this project?
Well, again, I think we want to remember that farmers aren't dummies that stayed on the land where the brightest and most innovative left to get jobs in the cities. That there's brilliant, sensitive, observant farmers in every part of the world that are not only adapting to climate change, but are problem-solving to deal with issues relating to water scarcity and salinization of soils and scarcity of fertilizers in some countries. And so I'm humbled by their intelligence and their capacity, what I would call environmental literacy, their capacity to read the landscape in which they live through their traditional knowledge and their own observations. What I would say, though, is that our society doesn't value the brilliance of farmers enough. And so with this American Traditions picnics that we're sponsoring with Slow Food and Chefs Collaborative, we're moving toward the first holiday that honors farmers just like we honor soldiers and politicians. We've never had a holiday in this country that says we all owe a debt to the farmers, not only in our own country, but in these centers of diversity who keep us fed every day.
And is there a particular gardening tip that you just love that you now share?
Well, I think one of the things that just surprised me was the degree with which Ethiopian farmers match different kinds of manure from sheep and goats and camels and horses and burros and cows to particular kinds of field settings. And when you see people caringly collect, reshape, and utilize manure of many different animals, taking hours to build this into their system, you never want to be derogatory about manure again.
Gary Paul Navhan's new book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. Gary, very interesting topic. Thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, I'm grateful. Thank you for the thoughtful questions, and thanks to your listeners, too.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.